from the reminiscences of Baron Alexander Wrangel, 1854 to 1865. When I lived in Petersburg before my transfer to Siberia, I was not acquainted with Fyodor Dostoevsky, though I knew his favourite brother, Mikhail. I went to see the latter before I left. When I told him that I was going to Siberia, he begged me to take with me for his brother a letter, some linen, some books, and 50 rubles. Apollon Maikov also gave me a letter for Fyodor Dostoevsky. When I reached Omsk at the end of November, I found that Fyodor Dostoevsky was no longer there. He had completed his time in prison and had been sent as a private soldier to Semipalatinsk. Soon afterwards, I was obliged, in the course of my duty, to settle for quite a long time at Semipalatinsk. Destiny thus brought me, exactly 5 years after the scene on Semyonovsky Square, at which I had happened to be present and which had been so momentous for Dostoevsky, again into contact with him, and that for some years. On my way to Semipalatinsk, I visited Omsk again. There I made the acquaintance of Madame Ivanovna, who had been very kind to Dostoevsky during his time in prison. She was the daughter of the Decembrist Annenkov, and his wife, Praskovya Ivanovna, a Frenchwoman by birth, who, like many other of the Decembrists' wives, had followed her husband into exile. Madame Ivanovna's husband was an officer of the gendarmerie. She was a wonderfully kind and highly cultured woman, the friend of all unfortunate folk, but particularly of the political prisoners. She and her mother had made Dostoevsky's acquaintance first at Tobolsk, whither he had been brought from Petersburg in the beginning of the year 1850. Tobolsk was then the clearing-house for all offenders transported from European Russia. From Tobolsk they were sent to the other Siberian towns. Madame Ivanovna provided Dostoevsky with linen, books, and money while he was at Tobolsk. At Omsk, too, she looked after him and alleviated his durance in many ways. When, in 1856, I returned to Petersburg, Dostoevsky asked me to visit her and convey his gratitude for all the goodness she had shown him. I must observe that the political offenders of that time were, in most cases, much more humanely and cordially treated by their official superiors and by the gentry than in later years. In the reign of Nicholas I, the whole of Siberia was crammed with political offenders, Russians as well as Poles. These were all cultured, liberal persons, absolutely sincere and convinced. But Fyodor Dostoevsky awakened quite peculiar sympathy. He told me himself that neither in the prison nor later during his military service was ever a hair of his head hurt by his superiors or by the other prisoners or soldiers. All the newspaper reports that declare otherwise are pure invention. For it has frequently been maintained that Dostoevsky's fits were brought on by the corporal chastisement he received, and many appear to believe this legend. In November 1854, then, I came to Semipalatinsk. On the morning after my arrival, I betook myself to the military governor, Spiridonov. He at once sent his adjutant to look out for rooms for me, and within a few hours I had settled down in my new home. I inquired of the governor how and where I could find Dostoevsky, and asked him to come to tea with me that evening. Dostoevsky was then living in an abode of his own, and no longer in barracks. At first he did not know who I was and why I had asked him to come, so he was in the beginning very reticent. He wore a grey military cloak with a high red collar and red epaulette. His pale, freckled face had a morose expression. His fair hair was closely shorn. He scrutinized me keenly with his intelligent blue-green eyes, as if seeking to divine what sort of person I was. As he confessed to me later on, he had been almost frightened when my messenger told him that the district attorney wished to see him. But when I apologized for not having first visited him personally, gave him the letters, parcels, and messages from Petersburg, and showed my friendly feeling, he quickly grew cheerful and confidential. Afterwards, he told me that on that first evening he had instinctively divined in me an intimate friend to be. While he read the letters I had brought, tears came into his eyes. I too was overcome by that mysterious sense of despair and desolation which I had so often felt during my long journey. As I was talking with Dostoevsky, a whole pile of letters from my relatives and friends in Petersburg was brought to me. I ran through the letters and suddenly began to sob. I was at that time unusually emotional and greatly attached to my family. My separation from all who were dear to me seemed insupportable, and I was quite terrified of my future life. So there we were together, both in a desolate and lonely condition. I felt so heavy-hearted that I forgot my exalted position as district attorney and fell on the neck of Fyodor Mikhailovich, who stood looking at me with mournful eyes. He comforted me, pressed my hand like an old friend, and we promised one another to meet as often as possible. Dostoevsky was, as is known, discharged from prison early in the year 1854 and sent to Semipalatinsk as a private. At first he lived with the other soldiers in barracks, but soon, through the influence of General Ivanov, he got permission to live in a private house near the barracks, under the supervision of his captain, Stepanov. He was under surveillance by his sergeant as well, but the latter left him alone on receipt of a trifling recognition. The early days were the worst for him. The absolute isolation seemed unbearable. But gradually he came to know some of the officers and officials, though there was no close intercourse. Naturally, after the prison, this new condition of things seemed a paradise. Some cultured ladies in Semipalatinsk showed him warm sympathy, most particularly Madame Maria Dmitrievna Isaeva and the wife of his captain, Stepanov. The captain, a frightful drunkard, had been transferred from Petersburg to Siberia for this offence. His wife wrote verses, which Dostoevsky was called upon to read and correct. Madame Isaeva, after her husband's death, became, as everyone knows, Dostoevsky's wife. In my time, Semipalatinsk was something between a town and a village. All the houses were built of wood. The population was between 5,000 and 6,000, including the garrison and the Asiatic merchants. On the left bank of the river there lived about 3,000 Circassians. There was an Orthodox church, 7 mosques, a large caravanserai, a barracks, a hospital, and the government offices. Of schools there was only a district one. In some of the shops one could buy anything, from tin tacks to Parisian perfumes. But there was no bookshop, for there was nobody to buy books. At the most, from 10 to 15 of the inhabitants subscribed to a newspaper, nor was that any wonder, for at the time people in Siberia were interested only in cards, gossip, drinking bouts, and business. Even in the Crimean War they took no interest, regarding it as an alien, non-Siberian affair. I subscribed to 3 papers, a Petersburg one, a German one, and the Indépendance Belge. Dostoevsky delighted in reading the Russian and the French ones. He took no particular interest in the German paper, for at that time he did not understand much German, and he always disliked the language. Between the Tatar and the Cossack suburbs lay the actual Russian town. This region was called the Fortress, although the fortress had long been razed, only 1 great stone gate remained. In this region all the military lived. Here lay the battalion of the line, the horse artillery. Here were all the authorities, the main guard, and the prison, which was under my control. Not a tree nor a shrub was to be seen. Nothing but sand and thorny bush. Dostoevsky lived in a wretched hovel in this part of the town. Living, then, was very cheap. A pound of meat cost 0.5 kopeck. 40 pounds of buckwheat groats, 30 kopecks. Dostoevsky used to take home from barracks his daily ration of cabbage soup, groats and black bread. Anything left over he would give to his poor landlady. He often lunched with me and other acquaintances. His hovel was in the dreariest part of the town. It was of rough timber, crazy, warped, without any foundations, and with not one window looking on the street. Dostoevsky had a quite large but very low and badly lit room. The mud walls had once been white. On both sides stood broad benches. On the walls hung fly-spotted picture sheets. To the left of the doorway was a large stove. Behind the stove stood a bed, a little table, and a chest of drawers, which served as a dressing table. All this corner was divided from the rest of the room by a calico curtain. In the windows were geraniums, and curtains hung there which had once been red. Walls and ceiling were blackened by smoke, and it was so dark in the room that in the evenings one could scarcely read by the tallow candle. Wax candles were then a great luxury, and petroleum lamps not known at all. I can't even imagine how Dostoevsky contrived to write for whole nights by such illumination. The lodgings had yet another great attraction. On the tables, walls, and bed, there were always perfect flocks of beetles. And in summer, the place swarmed with fleas. Every day made us greater friends. Dostoevsky visited me several times a day, as often as his military and my official duties permitted. He often lunched with me, and particularly enjoyed an evening at my house when he would drink a vast quantity of tea and smoke endless cigarettes. My intercourse with Dostoevsky soon attracted attention in the circle most concerned. I noticed that my letters were delayed for some days in transmission to me. My enemies, and I had not a few among the venal officials, often asked me ironical questions about Dostoevsky and expressed their surprise at my consorting with a private. Even the governor warned me and said that he was afraid of the evil influence which the revolutionary Dostoevsky might have on one of my youth and inexperience. The military governor, Spiridonov, was an uncommonly pleasant, humane, and unaffected man, and noted for his unusual hospitality. Being of such high rank, he was naturally the most important person in the town. I lunched with him every other day, and enjoyed his fullest confidence. I wanted him to have the opportunity of knowing Dostoevsky better, and begged for permission to bring the exile to his house. He pondered this a while and said, "Well, bring him some time, but tell him that he is to come quite without ceremony in his uniform." Spiridonov very soon grew to like Dostoevsky. He helped him in every way he could. After the military governor had set the example, the better families of Semipalatinsk opened their doors to Dostoevsky. There were no amusements of any sort in the town. During the 2 years of my stay, not a single musician came to the place. The one piano was regarded more as a rarity than anything else. Once the regimental clerks got up amateur theatricals in the riding school. Dostoevsky was very useful in giving them advice and persuaded me to be present on the night. The whole town assembled in the riding school. The fair sex was particularly well represented. This performance ended in a great scandal. In the pause between two acts, some regimental clerks appeared as soloists and offered such indecent ditties for the company's amusement that the ladies took flight, though the officers, led by the commander of the battalion, one Bielikov, roared with laughter. I can't remember a single dance, picnic, or organized excursion. Everyone lived for himself. The men drank, ate, played cards, made scandals, and visited the rich Tartars of the neighborhood. The women busied themselves chiefly with gossip. In Semipalatinsk there were other political offenders. Poles and whilom Hungarian officers of Russian-Polish origin. When Gergely in 1848 surrendered with his army to Russia, Tsar Nicholas I treated the officers who had been taken prisoners in the war as though they had been formerly his subjects and sent them to Siberia. The Poles kept to themselves and held no intercourse with others. The rich ones looked after the poor, and there prevailed in general great solidarity among them. Fyodor Dostoevsky did not like these Poles, and usually avoided them. We became acquainted with only one, the engineer Hirschfeld, who often visited us and brought a certain variety into our monotonous life. I grew fonder and fonder of Dostoevsky. My house was open to him day and night. When I returned from duty, I often found him there already, having come to me from the drill ground or the regimental office. He would be walking up and down the room with his cloak unfastened, smoking a pipe and talking to himself. His head was always full of new ideas. I can still remember distinctly one such evening. He was then occupied with Uncle's Dream and Stepanchik of a Village. He was in an infectiously cheerful mood, laughing, telling me of his uncle's adventures, singing operatic airs, when my servant Adam brought in some amber-coloured sturgeon soup. He declared that he was hungry and urged Adam to hurry up with the rest of the meal. He greatly liked this Adam, always stood up for him, and would give him money, which afforded my Leporello, a terrible drunkard, quite superfluous opportunities for one more. Fyodor Dostoevsky's favourite authors were Gogol and Victor Hugo. When he was in a good temper, he liked to declaim poetry, and especially Pushkin's. His favourite piece was The Banquet of Cleopatra, from the Egyptian Nights. He would recite it with glowing eyes and ardent voice. I must observe that at that time I was little interested in literature. I had devoted myself wholly to dry erudition, and this often made Dostoevsky angry. More than once he said to me, "Do throw away your professorial textbooks." He often sought to convince me that Siberia could have no future because all the Siberian rivers run into the Arctic Sea. At that time, Muravyov's achievements on the Pacific coast were unknown to the world, and of the Great Siberian Railway no one had so much as dared to dream. Such a plan would have been taken for the delirium of a madman. I myself could not help laughing when Bakunin, whose acquaintance I made in 1858, unfolded the idea to me. More and more I grew to care for Dostoevsky. How highly I esteemed him is evident from my letters to my relatives. These I have at hand today. On April the 2nd, 1856, I wrote from Semipalatinsk, "Destiny has brought me into contact with a man of rare intellect and disposition, the gifted young author Dostoevsky. I owe him much. His words, counsels, and ideas will be a source of strength to me throughout all my life. I work daily with him. At the moment, we think of translating Hegel's Philosophy and the Psyche of Carus. He is deeply religious, frail of body, but endowed with iron will. Do try, my dear Papa, to find out if there is any idea of an amnesty." In a letter to one of my sisters, I read, "I beg of you to persuade Papa to find out through Alexander Weimann whether any prisoners are to be pardoned on the occasion of the coronation festivities, and whether one could do anything for Dostoevsky with Dubelt or Prince Arlov. Is this remarkable man to languish here forever as a private? It would be too terrible. I am sorely distressed about him. I love him like a brother and honour him like a father." Dostoevsky's indulgence for everyone was quite extraordinary. He found excuses for even the worst of human traits, and explained them all by defective education, the influence of environment, and inherited temperament. "Ah, my dear Alexander Yegorovich, God has made men so once for all," he used to say. He sympathized with all who were abandoned by destiny, with all the unhappy, ill, and poor. Everyone who knew him well knows of his extraordinary goodness of heart. How pathetic is his solicitude, for instance, about his brother Mikhail's family, about little Pasha Isaev, and many others besides. We often spoke of politics, too. Of his trial he did not care to talk, and I never alluded to it of my own accord. All I heard from him was that he had never liked Petrushevsky or approved his plans. He had always been of opinion that there should be no thought of a political upheaval in Russia at that period, and that the idea of a Russian constitution on the model of those of West European states was, considering the ignorance of the great mass of the people, nothing less than ridiculous. He often thought of his comrades, Durov, Plesheyev, and Grigoriev. He corresponded with none of them, though. Through my hands went only his letters to his brother Mikhail, once in a way to Apollon Maikov, to his aunt Kamanina, and to young Yakushkin. And now I must relate what I know of his epileptic fit. I never, thank God, saw one of them, but I know that they frequently recurred. His landlady usually sent for me at once. After the fits, he always felt shattered for 2 or 3 days, and his brain would not work. The first fits, as he declared, had overtaken him in Petersburg, but the malady had developed in prison. At Semipalatinsk he would have one every 3 months. He told me that he could always feel the fit coming on, and always experienced beforehand an indescribable sense of well-being. After each attack, he presented a woefully dejected aspect. Fyodor Dostoevsky led a more sociable life than I did. He went particularly often to the Isaevs. He would spend whole evenings at that house, and among other things gave lessons to the only son, Pasha, an intelligent boy of 8 or 9. Maria Dmitrievna Isaeva was, if I am not mistaken, the daughter of a schoolmaster, and had married a junior master. How he had come to be in Siberia, I cannot say. Isaev suffered from pulmonary consumption, and was, moreover, a great drunkard. Otherwise, he was a quiet, unpretentious person. Maria Dmitrievna was about 30, an extremely pretty blonde of middle height, very thin, passionate, and exalté. Even then, one often saw a hectic flush on her cheek. Some years later, she died of consumption. She was well-read, not unaccomplished, witty and appreciative of wit, very good-hearted, and uncommonly vivacious and romantic. She took a warm interest in Fyodor Mikhailovich. I do not think that she highly esteemed him. It was more that she pitied him. Possibly she was attached to him also, but in love with him she most decidedly never was. She knew that he had epileptic attacks, and that he suffered dire poverty. She often said he was a man without a future. But Fyodor Mikhailovich took her compassion and sympathy for love, and adored her with all the ardour of his youth. He would spend whole days at the Isaevs, and tried to induce me to go there too, but the family did not attract me. In the beginning of March, Squadron Adjutant Akhmatov came to Omsk. He had done the journey from Petersburg in 10 days, with news of the decease of Tsar Nicholas I. The news reached us in Semipalatinsk on March the 12th. Rumours of the clemency and mildness of the new Tsar had already penetrated to Semipalatinsk. I went with Dostoevsky to the Requiem Mass. The general demeanour was grave enough, but one saw not a single tear. Only some old officers and soldiers so much as sighed. Dostoevsky now began to hope for a change in his fate, for an amnesty. Most of all, we discussed the question of whether the Crimean War would go on. In the summer, I went into the country with Dostoevsky to the so-called Kasakov Gardens. The place lay on the high bank of the Irtysh. We built a bathing box close to the bank among bush, underwood and sedge, and began bathing as early as May. We also worked hard in the flower garden. I can see Dostoevsky now, watering the plants. He would take off his regimental cloak and stand among the flower beds in a pink cotton shirt. Round his neck hung a long chain of little blue glass beads, probably a keepsake from some fair hand. On this chain he carried a large bulbous silver watch. He was quite fascinated with gardening and took great delight in it. The summer was extraordinarily hot. The two daughters of Dostoevsky's landlady in the town often helped us with our gardening. After some hours of work, we would go to bathe and then drink tea up above. We read newspapers, smoked, talked about our Petersburg friends, and abused Western Europe. The Crimean War still lasted, and we were both in a gloomy frame of mind. I passionately loved riding. One day I succeeded in persuading Dostoevsky to try a mount, and placed one of the gentlest of my horses at his disposal. For this was the first time in his life that he had ever been on horseback. Comical and awkward as he looked in the saddle, he soon grew to like riding, and thenceforth we began to take long canters over the steppes. Dostoevsky's love for Madame Isaeva was by no means cooling all this time. He went to her house as often as he could, and would come back in a perfect ecstasy. He could not understand why I failed to share his enchantment. Once he returned in utter despair, and told me that Isaev was to be transferred to Kuznetsk, a town 500 versts distant from Semipalatinsk. "And she is quite calm, appears to see nothing amiss with it. Isn't that maddening?" he said bitterly. Isaev was really transferred soon after that to Kuznetsk. Dostoevsky's despair was immeasurable. He nearly went out of his mind. He regarded the impending goodbye to Maria Dmitrievna as a goodbye to life. It turned out that the Isaevs were heavily in debt. When they had sold all they had in payment of these obligations, they had nothing left over for the journey. I helped them out, and at last they started. I shall never forget the leave-taking. Dostoevsky wept aloud like a little child. Many years afterwards, in a letter to me of March the 31st, 1865, he alluded to that scene. Dostoevsky and I decided to go part of the way with the Isaevs. I took him in my carriage. The Isaevs sat in an open diligence. Before the departure, they all turned in to drink a glass of wine at my house. So as to enable Dostoevsky to have one last talk undisturbed with Maria Dmitrievna before she went, I made her husband properly drunk. On the way, I gave him some more champagne, thus getting him wholly into my power, then took him into my carriage, where he forthwith fell asleep. Fyodor Mikhailovich went into Maria Dmitrievna's. It was a wonderful, clear, moonlight night in May. The air was filled with soft perfume. Thus we drove a long way. At last we were obliged to part. Those two embraced for the last time and wiped the tears from their eyes, while I dragged the drunken and drowsy Isaev over to the carriage. He at once went off again, and never knew in the least what had been done with him. Little Pasha was fast asleep too. The diligence set off. A cloud of dust arose. Already we could see it no more, and the sound of the little bells was dying away in the distance. But Dostoevsky stood stark and dumb, and the tears were streaming down his cheeks. I went up to him, took his hand. He awoke from his trance, and, without saying a word, got into the carriage. We did not get back till dawn. Dostoevsky did not lie down and try to sleep, but kept walking to and fro in his room, talking to himself. After that sleepless night, he went to camp for drill. Home again, he lay there the whole day, neither eating nor drinking, and smoking pipe after pipe. Time did its work, and Dostoevsky's morbid despair came to an end. He was in constant communication with Kuznetsk, but that did not always bring him happiness. Fyodor Mikhailovich had gloomy forebodings. Madame Isaeva, in her letters, complained of bitter poverty, of her own ill health, and the incurable sufferings of her husband, of the joyless future which awaited her. And all this sorely depressed Dostoevsky. He failed more and more in health, became morose, irritable, and looked like the shadow of a man. He even gave up working at the House of the Dead, which he had begun with such ardour. Only when, on warm evenings, we lay in the grass and looked up to the star-sown sky, did he know relative well-being. Such moments had a tranquilizing effect on him. We seldom spoke of religion. He was at heart religious, though he rarely entered a church. The popes, and especially the Siberian ones, he could not stand at all. Of Christ he would speak with moving rapture. His manner in speech was most peculiar. In general, he did not speak loudly, often indeed in a whisper, but when he grew enthusiastic, his voice would become louder and more sonorous. And when he was greatly excited, he would pour forth words and enchain his hearers by the passion of his utterance. What wonderful hours I have passed with him! How much I owe to my intercourse with that greatly gifted man! In the whole of our life together there was never a single misunderstanding between us. Our friendship was untroubled by one cloud. He was 10 years older and much more experienced than I. Whenever, in my youthful crudity, I began, terrified by the repellent environment, to lose heart, Dostoevsky would always tell me to take courage, would renew my energies by his counsel and his warm sympathy. I cherish his memory especially on account of the human feeling with which he inspired me. After all this, the reader will understand that I could not be an indifferent witness of the unhappy frame of mind into which his unfortunate relation with Madame Isaeva had brought him. I made up my mind to distract him from it in every way I could. On every opportunity I brought him about with me, and made him known to the engineers of the lead and silver mines that lie nearby. But I found it very hard to woo him from his mournful brooding. He had got superstitious all of a sudden, and would often tell me tales of somnambulists or visit fortune-tellers, and as I, at 20, had my own romance, he took me to an old man who told fortunes by beans. About this time I heard from Petersburg that the new Tsar was gracious and unusually clement, that people were feeling a new spirit in things and expecting great reforms. This news had a most encouraging effect on Dostoevsky. He grew more cheerful, and much more rarely refused the distractions that I offered him. One day there came tidings from Omsk that in consequence of the political tension on the southern border and the unrest among the Circassians, the governor of Omsk was coming to Semipalatinsk to review the troops. It was said that on this occasion he would also review the rest of the Siberian garrisons. So Dostoevsky, like the rest, had to prepare for the possible campaign in every way. He had to get boots, a waterproof coat, linen, and other indispensable clothing. In a word, to equip himself afresh from head to foot. For he possessed no clothes but those he had on. Again he needed money, again he racked his brains to think where to get it. These cursed money worries never left him. From his brother Mikhail and his aunt, he had just then had a small sum, so he could not possibly ask them again. Such anxieties tormented him terribly, and from Kuznetsk the news grew more troubling every day. Madame Isaeva was dying of loneliness beside her sick and ever-drunken husband, and complained in all her letters of isolation and want of someone to talk to. In her more recent letters there often occurred the name of a new acquaintance, an interesting young teacher and colleague of her husband. In each succeeding letter she spoke of him with more enthusiasm and pleasure. She praised his kindness, his fidelity, and his remarkable powers of affection. Dostoevsky was tortured by jealousy, and his dark mood had, moreover, a harmful influence on his state of health. I was sorely distressed about him, and resolved to arrange a meeting with Maria Dmitrievna at Smiev, halfway between Kuznetsk and Semipalatinsk. I hoped that an interview might put an end to the unhappy state of affairs, but I had set myself a difficult task. How was I to take Dostoevsky from Semipalatinsk to Smiev without anybody's knowledge? The authorities would never permit him so long a journey. The governor and the colonel had already twice refused his applications for leave. It reduced itself simply to taking our chance. I wrote at once to Kuznetsk and asked Maria Dmitrievna to come to Smiev on a certain day. At the same time, I spread a rumour in town that Dostoevsky had been so run down by several violent epileptic attacks that he was obliged to keep his bed. I also informed his colonel that he was ill and under treatment by the military doctor, Lamotte. This Lamotte, however, was our good friend and in our confidence. He was a Pole, formerly a student at the University of Vilna, and had been sent to Siberia for some political misdemeanour. My servants were instructed to say to everyone that Dostoevsky was lying ill in my house. The shutters were shut to keep the light from disturbing the invalid. Nobody was allowed to enter. Luckily for us, all the commanding officers were away, from the military governor downwards. Everything was in our favour. We started about 10 o'clock at night. We drove like the wind, but poor Dostoevsky thought we were going at a snail's pace and conjured the coachman to drive still faster. We travelled all night and reached Smiev by morning. How terrible was Dostoevsky's disappointment when we were told that Maria Dmitrievna was not coming. A letter from her had arrived in which she told us that her husband was worse, and moreover that she had no money for the journey. I can't attempt to convey the despair of Dostoevsky. I had to rack my brains to tranquillize him in any sort of way. That same day we returned, having done the 300 versts in 28 hours. Once at home, we changed our clothes and instantly went to see some acquaintances, so nobody ever knew anything about our prank. Our life went monotonously on. Dostoevsky was mostly in dejected mood, and at times worked very hard. I tried to divert him as well as I could. There was no variety at all in our way of life. We walked daily to the bank of the Irtysh, worked in the garden, bathed, drank tea, and smoked on the balcony. Sometimes I would sit with a rod by the water, while Dostoevsky lay near me on the grass and read aloud. All the books I had were gone through countless times in this way. Among others, he read to me, for my instruction, Aksakov's Angling and A Sportsman's Sketches. There was no library in the town. The numerous books on zoology and natural science that I had brought from Petersburg I knew almost by heart. Dostoevsky preferred fine literature, and we eagerly devoured any new book. The monotony of our lives was redeemed, however, by the hours in which Dostoevsky's creative inspiration came over him. In such hours he was in so uplifted a state that I too was infected by it. Even life in Semipalatinsk seemed not so bad in those moments, but alas, the mood always went as suddenly as it had come. Every unfavourable report from Kuznetsk brought it to an end at one blow. Dostoevsky instantly collapsed and was seedy and wretched again. As I have already mentioned, he was then working at the House of the Dead. I had the great good luck to see Dostoevsky in his inspired state and to hear the first drafts of that incomparable work from his own lips. Even now, after all these years, I recall those moments with a sense of exultation. I was always amazed by the superb humanity that glowed in Dostoevsky's soul, despite his grievous destiny, despite the prison, the exile, the terrible malady, and the eternal want of money. Not less was I astonished by his rare guilelessness and gentleness, which never left him even in his worst hours. Baron Frangl goes on to tell of the arrival of the Governor-General Hasford at Semipalatinsk, and of his arrogant and domineering manner. I was invited to lunch with the other officials at the Governor's. I had known his wife in Petersburg. She received me very cordially and offered me a place by her side. At the table the Governor assumed quite a different tone and behaved like an ordinary mortal. He seemed in good spirits, asked me about my acquaintances, and let fall the remark that he was well aware of my relations with Dostoevsky. I made up my mind to play upon his better temper and win him to Dostoevsky's cause. Dostoevsky had shortly before written a poem on the death of Tsar Nicholas I. We wanted to send it through General Hasford to the widowed Tsarina. The poem began, if I remember rightly, in this way. As evening red dies in the heavens, so sank thy glorious spouse to rest. To my most respectfully proffered request, Hasford replied with an energetic no, and added, I'll do nothing for a whilom enemy of the government. But if they take him up in Petersburg of their own accord, I shall put no obstacle in the way. The poem reached the Tsarina nevertheless, and that in the following way. I wrote two or three times to my father and my influential relations, and begged them to discover some means of bringing it to the Tsarina's notice. My endeavours were finally crowned with success. Prince Peter Georgovich von Oldenburg undertook to deliver the poem. The prince was an impassioned musician and a bad composer. At that time he consorted much with the well-known pianist Adolf Henselt, who had to correct his compositions. This Henselt had been for many years teaching music in our family. My relatives applied to him, and he willingly acceded to our request. The poem really did reach the Tsarina. This was told me later by a high official. Dostoevsky wrote yet another poem, On the Accession of Alexander II. This I later gave personally to General Eduard Ivanovich Totleben. Dostoevsky was now terribly affected by his malady. Often he feared for his reason. He clearly perceived the aim of his life to be literary work. But so long as he was in exile, he would not be allowed to publish his works. In his despair, he even begged me to let them appear under my name. But I did not agree to this proposal, flattering as it was for me, I need not say. Literature, moreover, was his only means of earning money. He was longing at this time for a personal life. He wanted to marry, and hoped thereby to find boundless happiness. For many years he had suffered the direst need. Who knows, if Dostoevsky had not taken that step for which his stern critics so severely blame him, one of the greatest Russian writers, the pride of Russia, might have languished to death in the deserts of Siberia. The projected campaign never came off. The Governor-General departed, and our Semipalatinsk society sank back into its lethargy. After their urgent activities before the Governor-General, the soldiers needed some rest, and so Fyodor Mikhailovich had a little spare time. We settled down again in our Kasakov garden, and once more the days were all alike. From Kuznetsk came the gloomiest tidings. Dostoevsky went no more to the soothsayers, bored himself to death, was always in bad spirits, and took no pleasure in work. He simply did not know how to kill the time. Then there occurred to his mind a certain Marina O., the daughter of an exiled Pole. When he used to go to the Isaevs, he had interested himself in this girl at Maria Dmitrievna's request and given her some lessons. Now he went to her father, who, after some time, declared himself willing to send her daily to Kasakov Gardens for instruction. Marina was then 17 and had grown into a blooming, pretty creature. She brought life into our house. was quite at her ease, laughing and romping and coquetting with her teacher. I was, at that time, absorbed in a love affair and sought diversion from it in long journeys. I was for 2 months absent from Semipalatinsk, and in that time covered more than 2,000 versts. Dostoevsky stayed behind alone in the summer weather, changeable of mood, teaching Marina, working, but not over-diligently, and keeping up a lively correspondence with Maria Dmitrievna. His letters to her were as thick as exercise books. When, before my departure, I saw how eagerly Dostoevsky was interesting himself in the girl, who was evidently in love with her teacher, I began to hope that intercourse with Marina would woo him from his fatal passion for Maria Dmitrievna. But when I came back from my trip, I heard of a real tragedy. On my first view of Marina after my return, I was shocked by her aspect. She was hollow-eyed, emaciated, and shrunken. And Dostoevsky told me that he had observed this alteration, but that no efforts had enabled him to learn from her the cause of such a metamorphosis. Now, however, we both set ourselves to question the girl, and at last she poured out the following story. The son of the mayor of Semipalatinsk, a youth of 18, had long had an eye for the pretty maiden. By the intervention of my housekeeper, he succeeded in making her his own. The scoundrel stuck to her for a while, and then deserted her. But that was not the worst. The boy's coachman, a rascally old Circassian, knew of these relations. He had often gone for the girl by his master's orders to drive her to the rendezvous. On one such transit, he threatened that he would tell of the matter to her father and stepmother if she did not yield herself to him. The terrified Marina, who had very little force of character, consented. The coachman was now blackmailing her and plundering her as he alone could. She hated and feared him, and implored us to save her from the clutches of this scoundrel. The case cried to heaven. I made use of my official powers and expelled the Circassian from Semipalatinsk. A year later, Marina was forced to marry, against her will, a boorish old Cossack officer, selected for her by her father. She hated him, and flirted as before with anyone she came across. The old man pestered her with his jealousy. Later on, when Dostoevsky was married, this Marina was the cause of quarrels and scenes of jealousy between him and Maria Dmitrievna, for Marina still would flirt with him, and this terribly enraged Maria Dmitrievna, who was even then marked for death. When I returned from a trip to Barn Owl, I found Dostoevsky still more broken down, emaciated, and desperately depressed. He always got a little more cheerful in my company, but soon he was to lose heart altogether, for I had to tell him that I should be compelled to leave Semipalatinsk forever. Wrangel left Semipalatinsk forever in the new year of 1855. The last days before my departure went by very quickly. By the end of December, I was ready for the road. Dostoevsky was with me the whole day and helped me to pack. We were both very sad. Involuntarily, I asked myself if I should ever see him again. After my departure, he wrote me a succession of moving, affectionate letters and said that he suffered frightfully from loneliness. In a letter of December the 21st, he writes, "I want to talk with you as we used to talk when you were everything to me, friend and brother, when we shared every thought of each other's heart. Our parting grieved me bitterly. I was young, strong, and full of roseate hopes, while he, great God-given writer, was losing his only friend, and had to stay behind as a common soldier, sick, forsaken, desolate, in Siberia. The day of my departure arrived. So soon as evening fell, Adam carried out my baggage. Dostoevsky and I embraced and kissed, and promised never to forget one another. As at our first meeting, both our eyes were wet. I took my seat in the carriage, embraced my poor friend for the last time, the horses started, the troika glided away. I took a last look back. Dostoevsky's tragic figure was scarcely to be discerned in the failing light. In February, I came to Petersburg, and now began an unbroken correspondence between us. His fate was not even yet quite decided. I knew that there would be a general amnesty at the coronation, but how far this would affect those concerned in the Petrushevsky affair was as yet uncertain. Even the highest officials of the police could give me no information. This uncertainty agitated Dostoevsky terribly. His impatience increased from hour to hour. He would not see that I, an insignificant little Siberian lawyer, could not possibly have any influence on a course of events, and that even my powerful relatives could do nothing to expedite his case. I did not want to pester them too incessantly, lest I should spoil all. But in his nervous excitement, Dostoevsky could not understand that. I did everything that I at all could. But Count Totleben was the most urgent of any in his cause. I had known Count Eduard Ivanovich Totleben from my school days, and had often met him at the house of my great-uncle Mandastiana, then commandant of the Petropavlovsky fortress. He had attended the College of Engineering at the same time as Dostoevsky, and his brother Adolf had even been intimate with the latter. Directly I arrived in Petersburg, I looked up Totleben, told him of Dostoevsky's insupportable lot, and begged for his support. I visited his brother Adolf also. Both showed warm sympathy for Dostoevsky and promised me to do all they could. The name of Totleben was then in everyone's mouth, not only in Russia, but all over Europe. As a private individual, he was unusually attractive. The high honours with which he had been overwhelmed had altered his character in no way. He was still the same friendly, good-humoured and humane person as when I had known him before the war. He did much for Dostoevsky by his intercession with Prince Arlov and other powerful men in Petersburg. Dostoevsky esteemed Totleben very highly and was much moved by his sympathy. In his letter to me of March the 23rd, 1856, he writes, "He is through and through of knightly, noble, and generous nature. You can't at all imagine with what joy I am following all that such splendid fellows as you and the Totleben brothers are doing for me." But the greatest influence on Dostoevsky's fate was that of Prince Peter von Oldenburg. He had known me since my school days. He was proctor of the school and came there nearly every day. And now, therefore, I was called upon again to turn to Adolf Henselt. I delivered to the prince, through Henselt, the new poem that Dostoevsky had written on the coronation. He mentions this poem in his letter to me of May the 23rd, 1856. "It would be, I think, clumsy to try unofficially for permission to publish my works, unless I offer a poem at the same time. Read the enclosed, then. Paraphrase it, and try to bring it under the monarch's notice in some way or other." I did all I could. The prince gave the poem to the Tsarina Maria Alexandrovna. Whether it ever reached the Tsar's hands, I know not. At the same time, Dostoevsky informed me that he was going to send me an article, Letters Upon Art, that I might deliver it to the president of the academy, the Grand Duchess Maria Nikolaevna. I never received that article. In the same letter, he writes of another article, which he had begun while we were still together, one On Russia. I never received that one either. All Dostoevsky's thoughts were now set on one thing, whether, in case of his pardon, he would be permitted to publish his works. Not only his passion for literary activity, but also his great need, obliged him to strive for recognition in the highest quarters. He then required much money, and had none at all. He had numerous debts, and only that one hope— of earning something by means of the many stories and novels with which his brain was always filled. In January 1860, Dostoevsky at last got permission to settle in Petersburg. As the climate there was harmful to his wife's health, he left her behind in Moscow and came alone to Petersburg. He took rooms in Gorochovia Street. We saw one another very often, but only in flying visits, for we were both carried away by the whirl of Petersburg life. Moreover, I was then engaged to be married, and spent all my free time with my betrothed, while Dostoevsky was working day and night. So our short interviews were chiefly taken up with loving memories of the past. On one of our meetings, we spoke of a forthcoming public event in Petersburg. I intended to make a speech upon the liberties and rights accorded by the Tsarina Catherine II to the Russian nobility. Dostoevsky instantly sketched a brilliant discourse for me, but at the meeting I controlled myself and did not deliver it. I was once present at a public reading by Dostoevsky. He read Gogol's Reviser. I already knew his masterly art in delivery. The room was packed. Dostoevsky's appearance and his reading were greeted with thunders of applause. But I was not satisfied with his performance that evening. I saw that he was not in the right mood. His voice sounded dead and was sometimes barely audible. After the reading, he sought me out among the audience and told me that he had not been in the mood, but that the organizer of the evening had urged him not to abandon the reading, and he could never say no to anyone. If I am not mistaken, that was his first reading after his return from banishment. When in 1865 I returned to Copenhagen from my summer leave, I found a despairing letter of Dostoevsky's from Wiesbaden. He wrote that he had gambled away all his money and was in a desperate situation. He had not a penny left, and creditors were pressing him on every side. This craze of Dostoevsky's for play was somewhat surprising to me. In Siberia, where card playing is so universal, he had never touched a card. Probably his passionate nature and shattered nerves needed the violent emotions which gambling afforded him. At all events, now I had to help my old friend out of his fix. I sent him some money, though I had not a great deal myself. With it I wrote, and said that he must positively come to me at Copenhagen. He did actually come to Copenhagen in October, and stayed a week with me. He extraordinarily pleased my wife, and was much devoted to the two children. I thought him thin and altered. Our meeting gave us both great joy. We refreshed old memories, of course, recalled the Kasakov Gardens, our love affairs, etc. We spoke much of his first wife, Maria Dmitrievna, and of the fair Marina, of whom she had been so terribly jealous. In this intimate talk we touched almost inevitably on his family life, and the strange relation, to this day a mystery for me, between him and his first wife. In one of his earlier letters he wrote to me, "We were both thoroughly unhappy, but could not cease from loving one another. The more wretched we were, the more we clung together." At the meeting in Copenhagen he confirmed that saying. I had never believed that Dostoevsky would find happiness in that marriage. Every kind of torment, the whole grievous burden that he fastened on himself by that connection, robbed him of all peace of mind for long and long. At Semipalatinsk, I had often tried to reason him out of his morbid passion for Maria Dmitrievna, but he would listen to nothing. Maria Dmitrievna was invested with a radiant halo in his eyes. Among other things, he expounded his views on women in general and gave me corresponding advice. Once, in talking of our Siberian acquaintances, I mentioned a frivolous and insidious lady of Semipalatinsk. Dostoevsky thereupon remarked, "We should be eternally grateful to a woman whom we have loved for every day and hour of joy which she has given us. We may not demand from her that she think of us only all her life long. That is ugly egoism, which we should subdue in ourselves." As I have said, Dostoevsky looked very ill during his stay at Copenhagen. Before that, he had complained in his letters of his state of health. Besides the epilepsy, I am a martyr to violent fever. Every night I have shivering fits and fever, and lose ground day by day. Even a perfectly sound man could not have borne the harassed life that Dostoevsky was then leading. Eternally in want of money, anxious not only for his own family but also for that of his brother Mikhail, pursued by creditors, in constant fear of being clapped in prison, he knew no rest day nor night. By day he was running from one newspaper office to the other, and by night he was writing, as he said himself, to order, under the lash. Naturally, all that was bound to have a hurtful effect on his health as well as his character. He told me of one incident among others, which will show how nervous and irritable he sometimes was. When in Paris, it had occurred to him to pay a visit to Rome. To do this, he had to have his passport signed by the papal nuncio in Paris. Dostoevsky went twice to the nuncio's, but on neither occasion found him. When he went for the third time, he was received by a young abbé, who asked him to wait a while, as Monseigneur was just breakfasting and would take his coffee first. Dostoevsky leapt up as though gone suddenly crazy and cried, "Dites à votre Monseigneur que je crache dans son café, qu'il me signe mon passeport ou je me précipiterai chez lui avec scandale." The young abbé stared at him in consternation. He rushed into his chief's apartment, came back with another abbé, and requested our Fyodor Mikhailovich to clear out at once, and let the porter of his hotel come and see about the passport. "Yes, I was too hot-tempered that time," concluded Dostoevsky, with a shy smile. But evidently this irritability long endured, for in one of his later letters he writes, "I have become frightfully nervous and irritable. My character gets worse every day, and I can't imagine what it will end in."